Thank you for joining us. My name is Cody McLean, your host, and this is the Mind Hack Podcast. My next guest is Paul Golding, and he is somebody I refer to as one of the smartest geeks in Silicon Valley. He holds 25 patents across a wide range of fields, from cryptography to computational aesthetics, which I had to Google, and apparently that means a subfield of artificial intelligence and its ability to express human creative expression in areas such as music, visual arts, poetry, and more. He was also the chief scientist at art.com, where he helped to create a new form of art called the Clio, which in a simple form is a TV that looked like an art piece and plays dynamic art that can evolve over time. Recently, he's been leading blockchain and AI research for a leading fintech marketplace lender and is also recognized as an IEEE prize winner for his outstanding achievements in electronic engineering. And that's not even the least of it. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
You have a very long range of interesting achievements you've achieved over your life. Where did all this come from? How do you have so many achievements that just to have a few of those, people would be grateful to have?
Well, I guess the driving force that underpins everything I do is a deep sense of curiosity and a kind of principle of how I look at my life and what I kind of deem to be leading a purposeful or successful life. I'm really interested in testing my limits. And in this case, the level of complexity of problems that I can handle. And so when I was growing up, this was like in the 80s, I remember reading Fortune magazine about Silicon Valley, which really was a silicon-based story back then. And we forget actually that silicon is still the driving force of technology. So I decided, well, that sounds really interesting and complicated. I wonder if I can do it. So I kind of set off in the direction of trying to become a chip designer, which in the UK was kind of hard because there aren't that many chip design companies there. But I was lucky to land a job in Motorola, and in fact, that's the only job I've ever had. Since then, I've been a freelancer. And the reason for that is to follow this quest of optimizing my career path to satisfy my curiosity and to see what kinds of interesting and difficult problems I can solve.
And recently, you've been working on a new company called Telos. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, Telos is actually very interesting to me and a very personal project, because along the way, you know, dealing with all these complex problems that I've been fortunate enough to encounter, the same problem always arises, which is how can I be creative? How can I maximize my creativity? So it struck me some years ago that maybe computers can help in that quest. So I think I was one of the earliest people to kind of adopt a paper-free environment where I take all my notes digitally. I've been doing that for a long time. And what struck me about my digital notes was that they were not that much better than writing notes on paper, in that they just appeared to me to be like a digital facsimile of paper-written notes. They didn't do anything smart other than I could search them. So this led to a kind of inquiry into how can I augment creativity using technology. And where Telos fits into that is in many of my projects, I've been standing at a whiteboard, you know, riffing some ideas with a team. And I noticed that whiteboards are most visual modes of collaboration, and the most common one, I think, still in companies is using PowerPoint.
Right.
They're just inert objects. I mean, when you think about it, a PowerPoint document is really just storing pixels and lines and shapes. It doesn't seem to know anything about what's in those shapes, what they represent, the knowledge. So Telos was an idea to reinvent collaborative visual tools like whiteboarding or something like PowerPoint or maybe Google Draw, but in a way that the software is built from the ground up to be aware that what you're really inputting into the system is knowledge. And then once it's aware of that, you can begin to use various AI techniques to, as it were, make the software part of the your sort of cognitive loop, your thinking loop, by design rather than by accident.
So in effect, you're trying to outsource some of the creative thinking from humans to AI.
Kind of. I wouldn't say outsourcing because, when you delve into what creativity is, I think it's still a very uniquely human and possibly the thing that makes us human is our ability to synthesize ideas, often seemingly from nowhere. That serendipity piece is absolutely key to creativity. If you look at the history of science, the history of creativity, the history of technology, serendipity plays a key part. And, although there are some gains in AI to kind of bring that randomness into the game, the real creative thought, I think, is still being done by humans. But what I wanted to do is augment that. Mm-hmm. So in other words, can the machine bring to my attention things that would, are salient in the moment that would help me to think more clearly? And one of the key technological augmentations I'm interested in is how can I eliminate, if at all it's possible, cognitive biases? What I've come to notice in my many years of being an innovator is the thing that characterizes the way a project unfolds is very seldom the rational, kind of clinical, technological ideas that we think might be guiding it. It's usually people's proclivities, their biases. And we all have them, and we all like to think also we're immune to them, but we're not.
Right.
And I was bothered by that, and I wondered, well, who's going to tell me that, hey, Paul, your thoughts here are just completely wrong, they're biased. So I thought maybe a machine could do it, that it has no axe to grind, so to speak.
That reminds me of a book I read, one of the most profound books in psychology called Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow by Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. And that's a book where they looked at the ground. They looked at all the types of human biases and fallacies. And they also noted that in most psychologists is that they can recognize when it's taking place, but you still can't stop that bias from taking place. Yeah. You still can't prevent it. So is in some way you're trying to notify people whenever a bias could be presenting itself?
Yeah. That's the kind of, the sort of theoretical framework. And in fact, you mentioned that book that was greatly influential in some of my sort of how I went about this, trying to solve this problem, if indeed it's solvable. But I actually wrote to Daniel Kahneman and asked him, hey, it seems to me that everything you're writing about is a catalog of every corporate mistake made in every boardroom I've ever presented in. Mm-hmm. Is there any work? Is there a body of work that has applied this to the kind of hands-on workplace? Because the thing about the workplace is it's easy to become inundated with fads and to become faddish. Suddenly everything is about being lean. And, what I've noticed is that the dogma of being lean overtakes the wisdom of being lean. And so people do just completely crazy things just to tick the box of being lean. And they're making all the same cognitive biases. They're really serving their own agendas or confirming what they thought was the case. So you're absolutely right. The biggest revelation of that book is that even when you know this information, you cannot make yourself immune to it. And I find that fascinating. And I just assume, it's actually made me more humble because I assume that if I'm thinking a certain thing, like my idea is a good one, I probably ought to question that. So skepticism, deeply informs my kind of attitude to life.
And just to clarify for listeners, so I even had to Google this myself, a dogma, which is a principle or set of principles laid down by an authority as I can't even pronounce the word. So it's
incorrigible.
Incorrigible. It's it's a set of the cultural standards that we have, and it's difficult to change them. But in some ways, I'd say technology is having a positive impact at changing these cultural biases. And this comes down to racism and various other bad aspects of society that I think is getting better. I'm curious, what are your thoughts on that?
It's hard to say. And in fact, this is, I almost find myself these days, whenever I have an opinion that's a generalized one, what's my view on politics or the world, I just assume it's wrong. Because the reason for that actually I think comes from a different perspective, which is I remember reading a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death by Neil Postman. And that book was about what is news, newspapers, you know, things like that. And he kind of makes the thesis that, you know, way before the whole fake news thing came out, that news is, it's an agenda. It has an agenda, usually a corporatist one. Mm-hmm. It doesn't serve what you think it does, more naively, the kind of purpose of just conveying neutral information. And when you reflect upon it, when you take an opinion about the world, you have to ask yourself, how can I possibly know if my opinion is true or false? You know, so someone might say, oh, you know, everyone in such and such a country is a racist, or all Republicans are this, or all them. And you, how can you possibly know? I mean, have you met them all? So it's easy to extrapolate and fill in with your own biases. And what the book that you mentioned, Thinking Fast and Slow, profoundly points out is that the mind just has no apparatus whatsoever. There's no evolutionary tools that we have to discriminate truth from falsehood. Mm-hmm. The best we can do is to establish what we think in our mind is a plausible explanation of events. And then we easily mistake plausibility for truth. So that's how a lot of, you know, politics works, let's say, that, or any kind of negotiation. You establish something which is has to be true to begin with, at least partially true, or both parties recognize it's true. And from that fact or factoid, you can then say, and therefore B follows from A, and therefore C follows from B. And they probably do follow from each other, and they're plausible. But the mistake is when you believe the plausibility of that chain means it's real. It's actually the truth. Mm-hmm. And that happens everywhere. It happens in corporations all of the time.
And that also comes down to, I guess, critical thinking skills. And I know that you have a very deep-rooted opinion about education and today's education system and its structure. If I recall, you homeschooled your kids. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I have three kids, and myself and my wife, we made a conscious decision to educate them ourselves. And for a number of reasons, first of all, as you might expect, it ties back to my interest in creativity. And when we had our first child nearly 21 years ago now, there was this kind of notion that more and more jobs are being outsourced, or either to cheap labor, or, you know, now increasingly, of course, machines. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we ask ourselves, what's the one enduring cognitive faculty that trumps all of this, that, you know, will pervade? And the answer, I still believe, is creativity. And so when you look at schooling, and, you know, I don't want to generalize here, but a lot of schooling, like, you know, let's call it mass schooling, large schools, they're not optimized at all for creativity.
Right.
They're optimized for passing exams. And, you know, I would argue, and it's not even a controversial fact. I mean, this is actually in much of the writings of many of the early protagonists for mass schooling. They're really designed to make people conform. In other words, to become great workers in the workplace eventually.
And a lot of people don't know that our current educational system stemmed from the revolution that we had of technology and advancement in manufacturing back in the late 1800s, if I recall.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. The so-called, you know, assembly line kind of process that Henry Ford introduced, it required workers whose best ability was to be compliant, to do the particular task they were tasked with, you know, very well and without question. I just don't believe in that as a principle. I mean, sure, everyone has to do tasks and do them well, but the one facet that humans have is creative thought. And it's tempting to think that only gurus and technologists and, you know, magical, mystical people have creative powers. That's just not true. Everybody has the ability to think creatively. That's actually how your brain works. And the most profound example is what we're doing right now. We're having a conversation using words and sentences that have never been uttered. The sentences have never been uttered in the history of mankind. They're all unique, what you and I are saying right now.
Right.
Yet we're doing it without thought, we're understanding each other. That's an amazing and, in fact, deeply mysterious aspect of the human mind. And that also enables us to think creatively, to the out-of-the-box thinking. And there's no reason why a plumber or a carpenter or the garbage collection guy can't think creatively. And probably they are thinking creatively. And I believe there's lots of people working in companies who have ideas and they just don't ever get heard. And maybe because they think it's not their place to state them, or, you know, the way things are structured is they just have to do their task, not think out of the box.
Right. A lot of people have these preconceived notions about themselves, that they're not creative, that they're not smart, that they're not capable of doing something. And then they never make that attempt. And so what would you say to those people? And also, how do you think creativity is going to augment this rise in AI in the future?
Well, yeah, there's sort of two questions there. We probably should separate them out.
Take one at a time. Yes, right.
Yeah. So how can people be more creative? There are a number of tools that you can all use. And, you know, actually, I've been trying to write a book on this for some time, basically innovation for the rest of us. The first is just simply to realize that there's nothing magical about creative thought. It's not something that only people with fancy job titles like rocket engineers and, you know, code warriors and ninjas things. It's anyone can do it. The reason that it becomes difficult for many of us is that we get stuck, you know, in the proverbial rut. And the best solution to that is to find ways to constantly change perspective or change view. Now, this doesn't mean, you know, you have to go on trips to Hawaii and sit on an island and contemplate. There's lots of simple ways you can do it. The one that I taught my kids is that this is when bookstores were still around, like Borders. We would go in and we would have to find a magazine about a subject we knew nothing about. You know, maybe architecture, sewing, playing the violin, whatever. And we'd try and read it, but read it with a beginner's mind, an open mind, and with a kind of attitude of enthusiasm.
Non-judgment.
Non-judgmental. It's actually surprising to me how, if you add enthusiasm to any task or outlook, you can actually, you know, make it 10 times more productive. So if you say, like, well, I'm not interested in cooking, it's just boring, for those that don't like cooking. If you say, okay, I'm going to set that aside and I'm going to read about, you know, like the science of making soup, because there is a science, believe it or not, to making soup. Hmm. And there's a great book called The Food Lab, I think, about these such things. And you say, you take the attitude, wow, I didn't know that. Wow, I just didn't know that. And that kind of seems like a simple and almost stupid thing to do, but it really does awaken a different mode of thinking, and it enables you to get out of the rut and change your frame. And the framing of problems is actually, you know, per Daniel Kahneman. And in fact, there's a very interesting book on this subject called Don't Think of an Elephant by George Lakoff. And, you know, the minute you say don't think of an elephant, what pops into your head is an elephant. And he talks about how the framing of subjects is really what affects your thinking. So being able to change the frame, even if it's just happenstance, you know, by mixing things up, is a key part to being more creative.
Right.
And anyone can do that.
And so another way of saying that is that to change your mindset or how you're framing the situation. And it's easy to go into a situation and feel like you hate it, or you have all this anxiety. And one popular method for speakers who have anxiety is that they just tell themselves, I'm excited and not nervous. And that actually changes their perspective in terms of where all this adrenaline is coming from. And they're able to go out there and be more confident. And another way, when we're going back to creative thought, there's a difference between the focus mode of thinking and the diffuse mode of thinking, where when we're trying to solve a problem, we can sit there and we're just sort of looped in this little section of our brain. But in reality, we need to let our neurons connect. And a way of doing that is by letting it just roam around on that problem. And so whenever I'm planning for tomorrow, I actually plan what I'm going to do the night before, so I can let my subconscious brain overnight sort of think how it's going to accomplish those items. And there's this subreddit on Reddit called /r/showerthoughts. And it it has a premise from this idea that we sometimes get our most amazing creative thoughts in the shower. And it's because we're depriving ourselves of all these external stimuli that our subconscious brain is finally able to push those thoughts into the surface. And I know in my shower, I have a little shower pad. So anytime I have amazing ideas, I can write them down. And so there's ways of going about of learning and being creative, as you say, that is not just this what they teach in school of just rote studying and just having to memorize and that's not really what creative thinking is or how to get outside the box, as they said.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, the shower thing is there's another phenomenon is, you know, just exercising and going for a run, let's say. By the way, I mean, there's no better activity for creativity and just anything you care to name about human health and well-being than exercising.
Right.
And in fact, there's a credible research. There's a paper by a team at Stanford that, you know, one of the best ways to be more creative is to go on walks. And the history of creativity of scientific invention and technology is littered with people who had ideas whilst encountering nature or out on walks or doing things where the conscious mind almost switches off. And in fact, in my original field, silicon design, one of the key breakthroughs in how you produce silicon chips was made by a Japanese engineer who was an oil painter. And in the process of oil painting, you know, there's a method whereby you apply paint and then you remove it with the palette knife. So this kind of applying and scraping. Mm-hmm. And he just did this purely for enjoyment. But in the moment, he realized that, oh, this method I'm doing can be used to produce silicon wafers for silicon chips. And so there's so many breakthroughs like that. But the other thing I would say is that we're talking about creative thought a lot, but often thoughts become stale or we stumble because we're not doing. And the reason is there's a lack of information. You're in a point where you don't know, should I do A or B? So there's some great solutions and very easy ones to that. One of them comes from still my favorite management guru of all time, Tom Peters. And I remember him saying, ready, fire, aim. You know, sometimes you just have to do and not overthink things. And it's not that that's a style, because some people mistake that. That's a kind of, oh, that's a maverick style. You just have to do and never think, you know. That's not true. There's plenty of times where critical thinking and planning actually is absolutely the thing to do. But you've got to recognize when you're stuck and you have a lack of information. And so doing will get you to the next step. Right. And it doesn't matter if you're heading it in the wrong direction. The mere fact that you're doing, you will get information that enables you to correct course. So it's not like flying a plane where, you know, you carefully chart the A to B route. It's more like, okay, I head off in this direction. Oh, and now I have new information. Could be that, you know, I like this thing, I don't like this thing, or I've learned this, I've failed at that. And failing is often a good source of information. Now I can correct course. So the doing is an essential part. And then I would say also just having some simple heuristics. A lot of people are afraid to make choices because they think they're going to be the wrong ones. So you can just have some simple rules, you know, rules of thumb or what we call heuristics that enable you to get going. And so one of them would be, you know, minimizing your downsides, but maximizing your chance of an upside. And that comes from, Nicholas Nassim Taleb, the Black Swan author. In other words, what are the real downsides if I embark upon this action? If they're nothing too harmful, then just go for it. Now, also look at, okay, what could happen if this really went right? If that's a huge upside, it's definitely the action to take. And so you just take it and then you move on. You just say, I'm moving on. I'll get new information. I'll decide again tomorrow, rather than kind of contemplating your navel too much.
Mm. Going back to an earlier point, you mentioned this in our last call, that Noam Chomsky had the quote, discovery is the ability to be puzzled by simple things. And if we aren't able to minutely zoom in on something, and it's so easy to be stuck out on the big picture and not to really be able to grasp the minute things. But I'm lacking an example for that quote I just said.
Well, that's my favorite quote, and it's actually been on, we put it on the wall of our homeschool room. We wrote it in marker pen on the wall. And again, you know, that's an example of breaking the rules. Usually you don't write in marker pens on walls, but why not? Mm-hmm. I mean, if the upside is that, oh, you know, I might just actually be inspired to do something. I'm a great believer in, by the way, what I call the bump into effect. You know, a great example is if you're trying to learn guitar or a new skill like that, if you're someone who likes to keep putting the guitar in the closet, chances are you won't pick it up. So you should leave it out where you're going to trip over it. And then that bumping into kind of reminds you, oh yeah, I should be, you know, have a play with this. So, you know, I wrote that quote on the wall as a kind of bump into effect prompt. And there's many examples, and it relates to dogma, is that many of the things we do on autopilot, and because for good reason, you know, society or the system we're in suggests that that's the way to go. And I'll give you a counterintuitive example, which is I think we discussed this before, that if you say, I'm going to sell my car, you know, a secondhand car, and two people offer you a price, you know, someone says, here's $3,000. Someone says, here's $3,500. Who should you sell the car to? Well, the obvious answer is the person giving you more money.
Right.
And now there's nothing wrong with that, but that actually is a dogma. It means the dogma there is that you think that my only objective is to maximize profit to get the highest price, which may or may not be correct. But the thing about this quote of Chomsky is to, whenever you do anything, to ask yourself, why is that the obvious answer? And the example he gives is Newton and the apple falling, which we can come back to. But why is selling for the highest price the obvious answer? And when you contemplate it, you realize it's because that's a convention. However, it might be that the person who's offering $3,000 is going to take that car and, you know, I don't know, drive it to Africa and distribute anti-malarial drugs or something like that. Mm. So in other words, there's an additional benefit. There's hidden information that may actually lead you to sell the car for the cheaper price, because you're now, your mental arithmetic of what is the benefit to me and others of selling the car has a different equation than merely just a dollar value. Again, I'm not saying one is right, one's wrong, but this point of this quote is that it's a simple thing that we maximize profit, but why do we do it? And when you ask the why question, you discover answers that actually can lead you to new insights.
Right.
The canonical example that Chomsky gives is Newton and the apple falling, because for 1,000 years, Aristotle had said that things just go to their natural places. Steam rises because it's going to its natural place, the clouds in the sky. Objects fall because they're going to their natural place, the floor. And Newton asked, yeah, but why? And because he was a guy who had discovered the principle of forces, he thought, well, maybe there's a force pulling it down, which actually was a ridiculous explanation at the time. We have to understand this. And in fact, deeply disturbed him, and he tried to prove it was false for the rest of his life. How can it be that there's an invisible force pulling it down? It makes no sense. Mm-hmm. Yet now we just accept that as a fact.
Right.
So actually, when you look at the history of science, the so-called scientific method is not really the fuel. It's this kind of ability to be puzzled by simple things and ask questions that hitherto were considered like preposterous. And we can all do that. We can all ask why questions about anything. And in fact, as you know, if anyone's encountered children, that's kind of naturally what they do.
Naturally curious, right?
Yeah.
And as we grow, we tend to get stuck in a certain way of thinking and doing, and then we don't question that. So it could be defined as critical thinking. And another thing that I like to think I'm somewhat good at is metacognition and being able to analyze my own thoughts and asking, where do they come from? And we have a lot of people in today's society who just accept the things as they are. And when it comes to the car, I think, you know, there's possibly economic benefits, and there's economic, environmental, political issues that could coincide with your decision as to who to sell the car to. And my next question is really, how does the average person draw the line at how far down the rabbit hole for issues should they go down thinking about their values? Or I guess that that's why we should have values and think about them. But how do you define that? How should an average person be able to determine what to think about or how deeply to think about it or when to question something?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because, you know, we know from, again, from the book Thinking Fast and Slow, that the so-called slow thinking, where you do question things, and the metacognition you're talking about is actually very difficult. It's exhausting. I mean, if you think about it, if you stop to kind of like check everything anyone ever told you, I mean, you couldn't do it. It's too exhausting. So you do have to rely on heuristics, so rules of thumb, and just social norms. Like, you know, we can have small talk without like really wondering whether the fact you just cited me, you know, or opinion you gave has any validity or not. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to disrupt that, of course. But I think the answer is to be authentic. I think we do know when we're just kind of like accepting something, but we're kind of like a little bit puzzled by it, or we're not quite certain if that's really the truth, or if there's a different angle I can have. And where that surfaces a lot is in how we interact with each other. And interaction here is both a benefit and a curse. So what happens in, as we all know, is, and actually this has been studied, an interesting thing, because I have a lot of meetings, or I try not to, in the field of, you know, technology. It's an established fact by psychologists that everyone in the room, and I always remind myself of this when I'm in a meeting, everyone in the room thinks that they're the smartest guy in the room, or they think that their ideas are in some way better than others. And in fact, it's nothing to do with the substance of your idea that you think that way. It's simply due to mental familiarity. Because you know your idea better than you know other people's ideas, because they're in your head, simply put, the familiarity, again, is easy to confuse with plausibility and veracity, you know, that this actually is a good idea. It's a truthful idea, a strong idea. And I find that the best solution to this, and again, is something, you know, I taught my kids, is what I call hilltopping, which is you have to really strive to put yourself, go across the valley. Let's say, you know, you're dealing with something, and the metaphor is I'm on one mountain or hill and you're on the other. Mm-hmm. And obviously from where you're standing, you have a totally different perspective. So I have to really strive to go and stand on your hill and see the world as you see it. And that then enables me to make a lot more sense of what you're saying. And I find this is a profoundly productive experience. There's no one, I don't think, that you cannot put yourself in their shoes, like, you know, your worst political opponent, let's say, in terms of, you know, your politics with a small p, by putting yourself in their shoes, that you can't understand where they're coming from. So I think that how far should someone go in questioning things is they should always have a healthy degree of skepticism, but of their own thoughts, mm-hmm. first and foremost. Because why do I say that? Because I can change my thoughts. I can't necessarily change yours. Maybe I shouldn't want to change yours, but I can definitely change my own thoughts. So one should learn to have a skepticism and a doubt in the healthy sense of one's own thoughts. That's not to be confused with passion and you know, and believing in things, but one should always have this temperate with I might just not be the right person here. I might be wrong.
And when it comes to empathizing with others, I was watching a great interview with Oprah, and she was reading this one interesting book, something about the power. I forgot the name, but she went on to say that a lot of arguments and disagreements are because you're not hearing the person. If you're having an argument and everybody's trying to get their point across, but in reality, the problem is both of you are not just sitting down for a sec and hearing what that person has to say and validating what they have to say. And if we could do that, a lot of disagreements and arguments would fail to get larger or be more problematic. And while you were talking, I was looking at my notes for thinking fast, thinking slow, and relevant to what you're saying about whether or not to think about some issues as they refer to it as the availability heuristic, which explains why some issues are in the public's mind and others are relatively neglected. And the best way we can do is to compromise by learning to recognize situations in which mistakes are likely and try harder to avoid significant mistakes when the stakes are high. The premise of this book is that it's easier to recognize other people's mistakes than our own.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Yeah, that was a groundbreaking book. I'm actually even writing a mini ebook in terms of my ability to go back in my own personal life and to see my own cognition going up a level and being able to first thinking I'm incapable, I'm not competent. And then once I achieve a certain success, then it just keeps going and going and going up and up. But it's all vague and abstract for a little bit. But that was an amazing book. If you haven't read it, would definitely recommend that you read it. So,
yeah, I mean, I think that book is profound. But again, it's easy to read it and, you know, have these kind of like insights and then do very little about it.
Yeah.
So you do need tools. And I think that, you know, so you have to train yourself. You kind of have to habituate to new ways of thinking. And so, you know, like the one I said is when I'm in a meeting, I find it's actually more productive to assume that or to remind myself that, okay, I think my idea is the better one. That's simply because I know it better than others. So what's the solution? To explain clearly my idea and not just the idea, because, you know, what I've noticed, and I used to take notes about this, it's quite interesting, is that I noticed that the people who speak the loudest and with the most passion, their ideas are often adopted. Yeah, that has nothing to do with logic, with the rationale of their ideas. It's another heuristic and it's also well studied. So if your goal is just to have your ideas paramount, then okay, keep at it. But if your goal is to truly discover new ways of thinking, the best solution, because you believe you have principles that tell you that the best thing to do is the best thing to do rather than the thing I want to do, then you have to like go in with a new mindset. And the one that serves me the best, has served me the best in terms of innovation, is to assume that I probably can really benefit from hearing other people's ideas and listening to them critically with an open mind. So you have to learn this kind of, you know, it's talked about a lot in the mindfulness kind of circles, this kind of non-judgmental thinking about your own ideas because it's easier to do because they're my thoughts, and then about the ideas of others. And to assume that you can always learn something from whoever you talk to.
Do you practice any kind of meditation or mindfulness technique?
I would say that I do, but only in the sense of that the aspects of mindfulness I found most useful to me is the, well, there's two, I guess. So one is this non-judgmental thinking, which you don't need to be in a state of meditation. And in fact, that's the whole point, right? I mean, mindfulness is a way of just always trying to be mindful. Right. So it's not something I do as a meditation practice. I more try to make it a tool for how I encounter others and how I do my work. And I find that more productive. Right. The other one about being non-judgmental is we all have like, you know, there was a great book I once read, which I think was called Dealing with Your Gremlins. And it was during a period of my life where I had lots of anxieties about certain things. And, you know, we maybe all have this. I think, you know, people who are sensitive do. You hear yourself, you have an inner dialogue, and the inner dialogue can be one of doubt or one of fear. And acting out of fear is, to me, not a good formula for being successful, however you want to define that. Acting on purposes. And so one of the ways I learned to overcome my fears was this non-judgmental listening to my own gremlins, which is just to recognize they're there, not to want to get rid of them, because I think that's an impossibility,
right?
But just to listen to them and say, yeah, hey, that's just my thoughts. Those are just my thoughts right now telling me you're afraid of this thing. Let's not judge it. Let's just hear the thought and do nothing about it. And then in a more calmer moment, or when you change perspective, you'll get like, you know, a different approach, and you'll realize, okay, I'm not so afraid of that thing. And it will enable you to act despite the fears and to remain functional.
And that could apply for anything. I know even addiction, there's another famous psychologist who he wrote quite a few books. And I was listening to one episode. He was talking about how we deal with addiction, where we often try and fight it and we don't want it. But another way of looking at it is if you view your addiction, it stems from what he refers to as a childhood trauma, is that we all have these traumas in our early childhood. And then we grow up and then we bring those traumas with us. And so if it's an anxiety, or even an addiction, one way is to, instead of being upset at your addiction, and then you get upset at yourself, and then other people are upset at you, and it's just this revolving circle, is that maybe you should name your addiction or name that anxiety, maybe call it Bob, and thank Bob for his help in your past and what he was able to do for you. But you can say, he's kind of like, you refer to him as like a stupid friend. Like he's a good friend, but you know, it's like, don't listen to him, you know, but he's still your friend, you know? And that's another way of reframing that anxiety or that addiction, and is a way to look past that, rather than seeing it as an enemy all the time. And going back to what you were saying earlier about mindfulness, you know, a lot of people think mindfulness is meditating or sitting down on a chair and then doing that whole Buddha thing. But mindfulness can apply to every aspect of your life. It can apply to, they have walking meditations where simply the idea is that you try and be present, you know, and whenever I would go for a run, it's so often, you know, we're listening to an audiobook or music, and we're just listening to that. But there's been times in my run where, at least in this one particular section, I always try and be present. I look at the trees, I look at the birds, I look around me, and I'm just like, wow, I'm so grateful to be here. And that has a mood boosting benefits. It makes you feel better about yourself. And the same thing comes to interacting with people, is there's moments where I can just have a breath in and a breath out, and I'm just present with myself for that one moment in time. And then I let my thoughts spiral and go outwards. So there's aspects that people can integrate mindfulness into their routines. And it comes back to even people who are angry or feel like they can't control their anger. You know, that's a mindset that first you have to accept that mindset, but recognize that it can change. And recognize that the more you can work on this, you can actually catch yourself getting angry before you actually even verbalize it to other people. And I think that it comes back to what you said, that we all have this way of doing things, and we get stuck in a rut and we deal with dogma. And it's maybe a big picture perspective is being able to recognize that we can change. And I think a lot of people don't feel like they can.
Yeah, I agree. I think one of the things you just said that I can relate to, and again, I would say is a practice worth pursuing, is when you're on your run, you're kind of in the moment and trying to notice what's around you. This actually is deeply mysterious, in my opinion, and I'll tell you why, and it relates to the work I did in computational aesthetics and art. First of all, when you're on a run, I mean, I personally go on the same route more or less every time I go on a run, and I listen to the same playlist. Mm-hmm. That's my own preference. But there's not a single time I've been on a run, and I must have done it hundreds of times now, the same route, the same playlist, where I can't see a new branch on a tree that I think I've run past, you know, hundreds of times that I didn't see before. Or a house that I just didn't notice before, you know, a whole home on the corner of the street, which I just failed to see before, or a nuance or a note in the music or a lyric I hadn't heard before. And, you know, you can do that. You can sit in your backyard, if you're lucky enough to have a backyard, or on your veranda or wherever, and you can look out at the view, which you think is totally familiar to you. And if you critically look at it, I guarantee you, you will see things you've never seen before. And where this actually was a profound insight to me is when I was doing work on how people view art. And it turns out, you know, almost paradoxically, that when you hang art on your wall, you actually do not really look at it. It really fills the function of occupying a space on the wall.
Right.
And of being somewhat symbolic of something that presumably you like. That's why you hung it. So if you hang a picture of a nature scene. Maybe it's because there's an underlying sentiment of, you know, I want to be inspired by nature. Maybe it's even more inspirational than that. You know, I eventually want to retire into the mountains or whatever. But I guarantee you, you have not looked at that picture or painting. You could do this right now. Anyone can go to a painting or a photograph on their wall. And now, instead of just saying, yeah, I know that's a picture of a vase with some flowers in it, critically look at every single thing in there. And you'll notice, for example, like, oh, hey, I didn't know that that vase was actually painted blue. I thought it was kind of red. Or you'll say, I didn't know that tree forked in the middle like that. And in fact, the reason is because you've never actually observed it. And that's part of what you're saying, is the ability to be in the moment and not to let your mind drift to, well, you know, I need to be somewhere else. I've got something to do. But just to absorb what is right in front of you. And I do believe that there is the scientific proof, and we could get into it, about the connection between being in that moment and actually being curious and the ability to be creative. Never mind the ability to be more wholesome and feel more grounded. And it enables you to deal with your anxieties, your fears that we all have.
Right. And another little side thing is we get stuck into using our phones and opening up the same apps. I think there was a study that said we often don't open up, well, most of the apps we download, we never actually open. And we only use about 5 or so apps on average. And an interesting idea is every once in a while, move the apps around on your phone. And so it sort of messes with your brain. You have to find out the apps, and it allows you to discover like new apps, or it allows you to try and recognize those bad habits of maybe you see an RSS feeder where you used to have Facebook. And so maybe you decide to just open that up instead of browsing on Facebook and whatnot. But I think where you're coming down to is the ability also to appreciate small things in life, where it's kissing your daughter on her way to school, or it's having that cup of coffee. And we often don't appreciate those things until they're gone or when they're not readily accessible to us. And so being able to be mindful and be present with those small things can actually make you appreciate your life and the things around you and the people around you much more than if you just get stuck in that robotic mode of job, sleep, eat, job, sleep, eat, whatnot.
Yeah, I actually subscribe to that point of view that the small things are often the most meaningful, and therefore you really need to be present in the moment for them. You know, looking back on one's life, the time that, you know, maybe you sat on a beach with a loved one, or you shared a cup of coffee with someone, or you had an interesting conversation, those are actually the little tiny moments that really are like the stars in your sky that you're navigating via, and all the stuff in between. You know, no one really says, hey, do you remember that time we, you know, read some great scientific paper? And you just don't tend to think like that. It's those connections, which I think what they have in common, those moments, is that you are most in the moment. You know, like in I'm from England, and we have this kind of like almost like a cliche that when anything's going wrong, you put the kettle on and you have a cup of tea. And in fact, you see that in a lot of English TV shows, if you watch carefully. Someone says, oh, you know, there's a big tragedy. You say, oh, I'll make a cup of tea. And the reason I think that that's so potent is that in the moment of enjoying the tea, you can forget about your other worries. And that's because you are really more in the moment during that, you know, sipping the tea. And it's no surprise that people, you know, certain cultures have extended that into a whole way of life, you know, like the Japanese tea ceremony and things like that. So I do believe what you're saying, this appreciating the small things, you know, should be on our list of things that make me successful or fulfilled.
Right. And it also, it's interesting when in technology, they try and automate some of these things when in reality, like I had brought the Breville tea maker, which will lower the tea into the water for the right period of time and then raise it back up. And it just always tries to make the perfect cup of tea, but then it removes the ritualistic aspect of actually making the tea and being present with it. And I actually felt like it made drinking tea for me less enjoyable than using the pot and actually measuring the time and whatnot. Because even though it took more time, it was a ritual that I was present with. It was a period of time in which I wasn't thinking about all the other problems and anxieties of my life. And that automation, that technology removed that aspect from it. So it's interesting how we have technology trying to make our life better, but in many ways it can make it even worse.
Yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying. I went back to having more traditional espresso machine so that you can go through the ritual of grinding the coffee, making, because those moments actually are where your mind can drift off. So you're being in the moment of, okay, I'm just observing what I'm doing. Like, you know, I'm grinding the coffee. Now I'm, you know, pressing the shot. You take time to look at the shot and smell it and absorb its nuances. But actually, you're unlocking that kind of hidden creative power in the mind where things will bubble up to the surface. And, you know, in my quest to be more creative, which I think is ultimately a good measure of being productive, those things matter. And it's interesting. I just read some research that if you want to prepare for an exam and memorize, the best thing you can do is not to cram and cram and cram, but to frequently walk away and do something completely different, you know, like go and cut some herbs from the garden or whatever, make a cup of coffee. Those are the moments that your brain is processing the information and making sense of it.
Right. And I wanted to jump to a slightly separate topic before we end the show. And it comes back to how you created your life and the values that you formulated it upon. Whereas a lot of people focus on money, wealth, success, which a lot of us can, you know, if we're having a conversation with another person, we're going to be like, oh yeah, you know, it's totally not me. But yet we secretly still strive towards all of that. And conversations prior to with you, is it seems that you formulated your life upon a different set of values that would create like happiness and meaning. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, I think happiness is overrated, and it's almost a kind of mythical quest. If you look at the history of, let's say, meaningful endeavors, meaningful works, works of art, works of science, they're often done by people who are anything but happy, and often because that's what the situation demands. So once I decided that I really am interested in chasing my curiosity to its maximum limit, in other words, you know, as all of the ideas that bubble through my mind, can I pursue them? And how far can I go in pursuing them in terms of their depth and complexity and their profundity, I would say, is kind of my quest. So I've optimized my career for seeking out interesting problems and working with interesting people. I didn't optimize it for, you know, earning X amount of money or, you know, all of the other things that we may think about. And I'm not saying any of those things are wrong. But what I noticed is I asked myself the question, okay, let's say, and I think this is worth doing, let's say I did have, you know, $1 million in cash right now, or whatever is the magical number. I asked myself, well, what would I do? And what would be authentic to me? Not what should I do, but what would I do that's authentic? And I realized, well, I would just dig deeper into, you know, even more interesting problems. So I thought, well, why can't I do that anyway? Can I do that? Is it a way to run my life? And at the same time, once I became, you know, married and started to have kids, I realized, going back to these small moments we were talking about, that those are really things that had meaning. And so again, if I was rich, well, how would I want to spend my time? Well, it would be with my kids. It would be with my wife. It would be drinking tea, you know, whatever, those kind of small moments. So again, I thought, well, how can I maximize for that? And then what I noticed is that, well, I should really optimize for being able to spend more time with my family and remain married to my wife rather than married to a job. So that's kind of what made me become a free agent and pursue interesting projects. And so that, you know, to me, it's like a good work-life balance. And I try not to see work as something separate from life. You know, this work-life balance is almost kind of meaningless to me. It's all life, because I try to work on things that I'm curious about, which is the very essence of life and living. So kind of that's how I went about things. And of course, I sometimes think, should I set up a business, have a passive income, all of these things? And then I realized, well, do I really want to do those things, or am I acting out of fear, you know, that I'm going to end up poor or whatever? And I always come back to the same conclusion that being enthusiastic about something and having intellectual curiosity is actually free of charge. You can pick up a book about poetry right now and try and learn poetry. You can pick up a book about art. You can become an artist. You can read papers. And now, you know, with online tools, if you want, you know, you can become a technologist without anyone's permission and with very little resources. So I think that, you know, is just kind of my philosophy, if it makes sense.
Did you ever have a concern about being productive? I recently wrote an article involving Charles Darwin, and he had this obsession with being productive. And when he was on the HMS Beagle prior to him going over to the island, he wrote to his sister, "A man who dares to waste 1 hour of time has not discovered the value of his life." And later on in his life, he ended up spending a very short amount of time actually putting together all of his research and his papers. And then he would spend most of the rest of the day with his family and doing things that were not related to work. But early on, he had this obsession with being productive. And I myself, I suffer from that as well. Anytime I'm not doing work, if I'm out trying to enjoy something, I have this little inner critic in my voice that says I should be back working. When you decided to marry your wife and have children, did any of this come to mind? How have you been able to balance that life of being, of living and also being productive at the same time?
Yeah, I would say that's a great question. And I think there's a lot of confusion around productivity, you know, which we could probably talk about for hours in itself. So obviously, if one sets out to do a task that you authentically want to do or you need to do, there's two ways of going about it. You can say, well, I want to be as efficient as possible, which means being productive. And sometimes that is the right thing to do. But other times it's like, well, you know, I have to do this thing. And the best way for me to tackle it is to be as most in the moment as possible. I'll give you a trivial example. I mean, I have in my backyard, I dug with a spade a very long ditch because I made a French drain next to a wall. And I like doing physical work, and I actually think there's benefits in doing things that require manual dexterity. They actually aid your thinking. And again, you know, this kind of like unlocking the creative channels. I could have like hired someone to do it. And in one frame, that would be considered more productive, you know, because I could have then been back at my desk, you know, kind of working on a tech problem. But I think there's no way to ever square that circle. I think you find yourself often, I believe that we mostly find ourselves in circumstances which, you know, we just find ourselves in for whatever reason. And so it's kind of, imagine you can plan your life, you know, down to every minute is a kind of absurdity. So in that moment, for whatever reason, I found that I had to dig a ditch. So I made sure I did it in the moment, and that it fulfilled a principle, which was being in the moment and also doing something with my hands. And so in that sense, it was productive. So the problem with productivity is you have to ask yourself, you know, what is the definition? What are we trying to be productive for?
Right.
And sometimes it is, you just need to save time, but you have to ask yourself, I'm saving time to do what? And you can get into a circle of I'm saving time to save time, and you never get out of it and have any meaningful experiences.
Right.
And then the other thing I learned, sorry to keep going, but is that I learned this from my work as a chip designer. You know, often the reason you need really powerful chips, you know, like microprocessors, is because you design the system in a way that there's one very short burst of work that has to be done in a very quick, fast amount of time. And that's like called peak performance. Mm-hmm. And so you end up designing everything for the peak performance. But actually what matters most of the time is maximizing throughput. So, you know, if you take, say, Ritalin to be like really super focused at one moment in time, that might be the right thing to do. But not if you subsequently, you know, waste your time, quote unquote, doing something else, and overall your productivity is no better. There's a difference between fulfilling the needs to feel like I'm being productive and actually being productive. And I think we have to be, again, skeptical of our attitude towards that.
Right. And even in Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers, he outlined, you know, it takes about 10,000 hours of deliberate practice to master something. But what he left out is the 12,500 hours of deliberate rest and the 30,000 hours of sleep that must accompany that. And so a big challenge that I've been working on is trying to reframe hanging out with friends or watching TV or doing something that I would generally consider being lazy as something that I can still consider productive if I'm recharging my batteries or if I have a clear intent on wanting to do that. But we could, again, go and talk about that for hours. In the interest of time, I want to thank you, Paul. This has been an amazing episode about creativity, metacognition, mindfulness, and so much more. You've been fantastic. Thanks again for being on the show.
Oh, thank you so much. The honor and privilege is all mine. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to talk about these subjects with you. I really appreciate it.
I hope to have you on the show again too. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hey guys, this is Cody again. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Mind Hack. And if you're interested in getting more Mind Hack worthy stuff straight to your inbox, then you might consider signing up for my weekly newsletter. It often contains links to new episodes, blog posts, and other interesting finds I found on the interweb in the past week. It pretty much focuses around productivity and efficiency. So if that's your thing, then be sure to visit my website at codymclain.com. That's MCLAIN.com to sign up. Also, if there are any interesting websites, companies, books, blog posts, quotes, or anything else that was mentioned in this episode, you can find it all and more by visiting the official website for the Mind Hack Show at mindhack.com. And as always, if you have any feedback, good or bad, I want to hear it. Send me a tweet, email, or what have you on either of my websites, as my goal with this show is to give you the maximum value in the shortest amount of time. That's all for now, guys. Thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you guys again soon.